EF United, the premier Cold Fusion Conference by TerraTech Programming. Created by developers for developers.
All right. So, gonna talk about Object Think for a while here. You guys been having a good conference so far? How many of you, it's been a pretty good conference. How many of you are gonna be here tomorrow, too? Thank you, Ozzy. Awesome. All right, so I'm Simon Horwith, the Chief Information Officer at About Web Solutions Training and Staffing Company just up the road here. And I'm gonna talk with you right now about Object Think. How many of you went to the design pattern thing that I did yesterday? Just out of curiosity. Okay. Well, now you're gonna hear a kind of completely different school of thought. All right, so first of all, just what am I going to cover in this session? I'm going to talk about just what Object Think is, just give you kind of an introduction to it. I'm going to put it into both historical and kind of philosophical context for you, let you know where it came from, right, what kind of shaped it, give you some guidelines in terms of how to start using this approach and, some of the benefits of doing that. And then I'll give you a list of some authors and, literature that I recommend, reading. There's some interesting stuff out there you can read about this. And soon there'll be some things you can actually download and play with from a cool, for Cold Fusion developers. Anyway, so Object Think, what it is, it's an approach to object-oriented programming, right? And it's based, by and large, entirely on the idea of personifying your objects. It's not about, looking up a pattern somewhere and, finding any sort of a cookie-cutter right way to do anything. And what's very difficult about Object Think is that it does require a very radically different way to think about how you're going to build your applications. It's not hard to do, it's just hard to change the way you think. Once you think that way, it's quite easy to implement, to be honest with you. When you use Object Think, one of the things that happens is you do tend to produce applications that have much fewer objects than you would typically have if you come from a more traditional OO kind of an approach to development and to planning. And it's based on creating what they call composable objects, which I'll talk about what composable objects are, but objects that communicate with each other. Which sounds kind of, everything communicates with each other in code, but I'll get more into that after I give you a kind of a, historical, philosophical kind of a perspective. So in the beginning, long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, about 40 years ago, which is a long time in, IT years, mid-60s, late 60s, right around there, computer programmers were considered more artistic, creative types. You had to be very smart to do this, but you had to be very, very creative. And, computers were a brand new thing and so on and so forth. And there weren't a whole lot of people who did computer programming. There also weren't that many computers in general. Computers obviously became more popular, started, being bought by businesses. A lot of companies decided they're going to use computers and buy computers and da-da-da. And the industry needed more programmers. We needed more people to do this. And unfortunately, there aren't lots and lots and lots of people that everybody considers very, very creative, smart types of people. Most jobs don't require a very high level of creativity. And that was a problem. When you all of a sudden have this big market and you need to get programmers and there aren't many creative thinkers out there, what are you going to do? And the mainstream, the IT industry in general, decided that the way to approach that is to create better IDEs, better programming languages, better tools, that will solve the fact that we don't have lots of creative people out there to write code. All right? This is back in the 60s. So the original idea behind object-oriented programming, most of the people I'm going to talk about at the end of this presentation, these are the people who they really were the founding fathers of object-oriented programming and of object-oriented thought. To be honest with you, most of the people I talk about at the end of this presentation, these folks were writing about object theory when computers were a brand new thing and there was no object-oriented anything. There was actually no way to even implement what they were talking about for about 10 years. But they did come up with, you know, this idea of objects and what an object is and how objects should work and, you know, that computers should move, you know, over to this this type of an environment. And ultimately, you know, that is what happened. Right? Unfortunately, because the industry thought, you know, there aren't a whole lot of creative types out there, we're going to build better tools and da-da-da. And we started, you know, having lots and lots of programmers, you know, people getting out of school with degrees in computer science and so on and so forth. You know, they relied more on the tools to do what they did. They relied more on looking at what other people who were working on these projects were writing down, namely design patterns, as the kind of way to approach doing development. And most of the original concepts, most of the original ideas behind object-oriented, you know, theory kind of got lost. They didn't get lost. I mean, they were still there, but most people forgot about it, didn't think much about it. Other than people in academia, you know, the academics did still continue to write about this and talk about this, and, you know, from time to time there were debates and such, but it wasn't a terribly popular line of thought. So I'm going to talk about traditional developers, what they typically refer to as, you know, formalist programmers, right? The formalist approach. Back in the 1700s, right, the 18th century, we had what was known as the Age of Reason. And you had Hobbes and Descartes and, you know, people like that writing about science and logic and a lot about science. This was back when philosophy and science were really still pretty much one and the same, by and large. And so that Age of Reason produced, you know, what oftentimes is called determinism or rationalism school of thought. And it's based a lot on mechanics, on man as an animal, and so on and so forth. Those are the kinds of ideas that became very popular. With the West becoming, you know, an actual, you know, the U.S. becoming a country, and so on and so forth, and, you know, countries were becoming very industrialized, it became a very popular school of thought. And to this day, it still is, you know, by and large, the most popular school of thought. Our society is largely based on this Age of Reason, you know, line of thinking. And we still have to this day things like the idea that if you want to market something and you say that it's scientific, people tend to think of that as being good. If you have something and you say that it's rational, people think that that's a very good thing, right? I mean, we even use the expression, you know, like a well-oiled machine to refer to something being very, very good, you know, which it doesn't get much more mechanical than that, right? I don't know what's so good about anything working like a well-oiled machine. That's not really how I develop software. It's a very different school of thought. One of the very common recurring themes in that formalist thought is the idea of central control, certainly in the field of software development, right? Whether I'm not going to start talking about frameworks and da-da-da. But obviously, if you come from a school of thought that doesn't encourage central control, that does present a bit of a dilemma when you start looking at frameworks, because they do tend to give you some of that. So anyway, object think developers, this is based on a very, very different school of thought called hermeneutics, which came about around the same time. It was actually named for Hermes, the Greek messenger of the gods. But anyway, and that philosophy originally was by and large all about linguistics and language, right? And the symbols that we use to represent things and how that shapes our perception of the world around us. After a little while, that philosophy and the writings about hermeneutics in the linguistics field kind of got extended to also talk about just the world in general, not pure linguistics, and a lot of theory about systems that are evolutionary rather than concrete and set in stone. That kind of thought came out. I don't want to get too philosophical, but things being self-aware, self-organized, things that evolve and respond on their own rather than needing to talk to anything else to do it, which is what the real world really is, right? I mean, the universe is not just a machine. You know, everything really is evolutionary in reality, right? So, getting back to the formalist thought, right? What that line of thought has resulted in, right, some of the things that it produced. Certainly case tools Tools that write your code for you, those come right out of that formalist school of thought, right? This pursuit of more intelligent IDEs, right? The popularity of waterfall development. Anybody here use waterfall development approach? Use that methodology? Most of you probably do. The very standard, typical, phase one, phase two, phase three. It's what pretty much everybody uses that I know, right? Most people have worked in an environment like that at some point anyway. But that came out of that formalist school of thought. The popularity without understanding of design patterns, right, and false ideas about OOP. A lot of people like to say that they're object-oriented programmers. I don't think most of them are, to be honest with you. A lot of developers, particularly Java developers, these are developers that use objects, but there's nothing object-oriented about what they're actually doing. There's a really big difference between using an object and being object-oriented in thought, in terms of what you're actually doing with those objects. So that's something that's definitely sprung out of this formalist school of thought. And then UML, the actual popularity of UML and design patterns in general, just this idea of writing down, set in stone systems that are, this is the way these things work. That did come out of formalist thinking, definitely. Right? And it doesn't follow along with really what you read about and what you come to understand if you study object think. So object think is very different. One of the fundamental beliefs in object think, if you read any of the literature, one of the first things it'll always tell you is that they strongly disagree with this idea of using better tools. They think that better tools will never be a replacement for better developers, ever, which I have to agree with. All right. Oh, how many of you agree with that? Out of curiosity. I don't know why you wouldn't, agree with it. It's not like I don't want my code writing to be difficult. I like tools that, complete my code and all that, but I don't like clicking on a button and having a wizard write all my code for me. Right? I still like to actually be in control of what's going on. The belief that domain expertise and modeling a domain properly before you build an application is the most paramount thing you can do in as a software developer, that is also a fundamental teaching in Object Think. The first thing you do on any project with Object Think is sit down and become a complete expert of that domain. You sit with your client and you don't start coding or planning or doing anything else until you understand their business and how their business works as well as they do. If at all possible, you have them, be with you when you're actually modeling the domain as well. Make them very involved in that process. But you can't build something if you don't really understand it the way that an expert in that system understands it. And that's a fundamental rule that they kind of always harp on in Object Think. By the way, if any of you have any questions or anything while I'm talking, feel free to, yell at me. Agile development. Anybody done that? Extreme programming, anything like that? Anybody here tried it or looked at it? Yeah. I like agile development. Some people like it, some people try it, and they don't like it. But extreme programming, the guys that actually founded extreme programming are some of the same people who wrote a lot of the original object theory. Right? And object think lends itself very well to an extreme programming, to an agile environment. Whether you actually prescribe to extreme programming itself and all of the various things that they tell you should do in terms of how you set up your teams and how a project needs to work and so on and so forth. But in a very, very simple term, for those of you who don't know what agile development is, it's just based on the idea of rather than having lots of stages of development, that just putting these stages together on a big timeline within a time frame is how you go about managing the development of software. You actually sit down and you figure out different they're kind of like use cases. They call them stories. But you find, you come out with these stories, and you tend to break off in very, very small groups, like two people developing together is very typical in that kind of an environment, where you actually have developers that work together on everything rather than everybody coding by themselves. And you literally just tackle stories that have been described. You can think of them as little use cases. It's the easiest way to think of them. Anyway, Object Think does lend itself very well to that, and it encourages that type of development. By the way, I also strongly recommend taking a look at some of the agile philosophy that's out there, some of the things that have been written about it, simply because you're Cold Fusion developers. I tell clients all the time, why are you using Cold Fusion? Or if they're using .NET, why are you using .NET? Or why are you using... And it's not that I want them to, stop and think about why they're using Cold Fusion and change their mind. I usually think they were smart to be using it. But I always like to ask them that because I think it's really funny how many of them don't know. Why are you guys using CF at your company? It's like, I don't know. It was here when I got here, or somebody just bought it and I came in one day and the box was on my desk or whatever. And the truth is, you really should be using whatever programming language you use, whatever operating system you run things on. I mean, you should use the tool that makes sense to use because of its strengths. You should always use a programming language because of the strengths of that programming language. What's Cold Fusion's biggest strength? Is there a room full of Cold Fusion developers? None of you know what Cold Fusion's biggest strength is? Yeah, rapid development. That is its biggest strength. And in an agile development environment, you find that oftentimes you are refactoring your code frequently. You are literally agile. You are reacting to different things very frequently in that type of an environment. It is a fast-paced development process. Cold Fusion is perfect for that. Cold Fusion is not a very good programming language for long, drawn-out, structured. No, that doesn't take advantage of its strengths. Not that you can't do it, and there's anything wrong with approaching Cold Fusion development that way. You still can. But you can really maximize that rapid development feature in an agile environment. So I like using doing Cold Fusion development in an environment like that, much more than Java or any other programming language. I think it's much better suited. It promotes a new way of thinking. Object think is just that. It's about a way to think before you develop. It doesn't really promote reading about design patterns. You won't find any in any of the object think literature out there. It doesn't really encourage using UML. These aren't tools that most object think developers find very useful. What they do use, there are a few things that they like to use. One of them is paper prototyping, which I'll talk about a little bit. The other one is something known as a semantic net diagram. Don't know, any of you ever done semantic net diagrams? Semantic net diagram, it's a diagramming technique. It's very fun. I'll talk about it for a bit in a minute here. And it encourages what they call emergence and malleability of objects. Dynamic typing is a recurring thing you'll find they oftentimes encourage. Right? They promote, they think it's a good thing in the object think, school of thought. They don't like things being so strict all the time, just as an example. But objects themselves are supposed to be able to react to what other objects tell them. They're not ever created for a single purpose that's set in stone. It always works that way. Not always. It depends on what you're building. But the objects are a little more intelligent, for lack of a better way to describe them. Okay. So I'll get into now. So some of the guidelines for actually doing this in development. Obviously, the first thing you want to do is if you're not planning your applications before you build them now, no matter how you like to do development, you should be. You really should be. With Object Think, you must do that. You really have to think about what you're going to do before you do it. So rule number one is everything is an object, which kind of goes without saying anyway. But to elaborate on that, what you are building when you build an object with this approach, you are literally replicating your real-world business domain, right? And everything in that business domain is an object, right? Object Think isn't really about tags and includes, and everything you do in terms of applying this theory is all CFCs for a Cold Fusion developer. Think like an object. Anthropomorphism. Your word of the day, anthropomorphism. I talk about that a lot. Anthropomorphism is all about literally putting yourself in the place of that object, thinking first person about that object, right? If it's an e-commerce application, you actually think, I'm the shopping cart, what would I do? What would I be aware of? All right, what do I need in order to do what I need to do? What do I interact with? You have to put yourself in the place of the object the entire time that you're modeling it. Right, so that's a very, very, that's probably what this all really does boil down to, is that technique, right? Objects are composable, which I mentioned before. The idea of a composable object, I think you all know what inheritance is, right? Or you have a good idea, right? The idea of like general objects and more specific objects, and you know, they kind of extend, you know, the children extend from the parent, and so on and so forth. So the idea of objects being composable, obviously, if you know, in your domain you may have a taxonomy of objects. If you do, you want to note that, you know, you always want to make sure that the objects that are lower in a taxonomy are more specialized, and that the objects, you know, those objects are actually built of, you know, the things that are you know, make sense to be inherited, which is not really very an object thing. That's just what inheritance is and how it works. But the idea that those objects don't vary by context is another one of the fundamental kind of ideas behind these composable objects. That, you know, if I create a shopping cart in this application is the same as a shopping cart in that application, is the same as any other shopping cart, right? Shopping carts exist to do something very specific. If I want to, you know, in an object think environment, if I build, you know, an e-commerce application where I've got a shopping cart, and then I go build another application for another client, I should be able to take that CFC, copy it over to that code base, copy it over to that, you know, that environment for that other client, and all I have to do is really just change the queries, just change how, where it's getting its data, right? I mean, other than that, the cart works the same way, right? Cart should still, it should still hold products, it should still calculate a total, it should still do all the same things that it did in the other application, and you don't want to go changing what an object does based on the fact that you've moved it into a different domain. That's something that you're always supposed to strive for. Use a language common to the domain when you describe the object. Like I said, you really want to learn that business environment, you know, that you know, model that you want to create and code. Become an expert in it the way that the client is. Listen to them. Use the same language they use when you're describing your objects. Yeah.
Doesn't using the language of the domain conflict with the previous one that says you can use that same object in another domain later on without needing to change it?
Well, sometimes I'll actually rename my object when I move to another environment just so that it looks like something the client, you know, if they keep talking about if they don't call it a shopping cart, they call it something else. I'll just rename the object, but it still does the same thing. It still is one of those. But what's very important to get from that is that the idea is that when you model your domain, and I do this when I work on client applications, I always have the client come in and look at my domain model and tell me whether or not I've got it right. And I don't ever have to explain anything to them. I mean, the goal is always for them to be able to look at everything you're going to do. They can actually look at my code, and I mean, literally, if you just look in my directory structure where my CFCs are stored, you know, these are all the things that make, you know, absolute sense to them. These are the things that they work with day in and day out. And I do, I name them the same way. You know, I use whatever the words they use to describe them or the words I use for that. I mentioned paper prototyping, so I'm going to talk about that for a second here. Paper prototyping, it's very similar to CRC cards. It's a similar technique if you've ever read about that. But the idea behind paper prototyping is basically for every object I'm going to create or that I think I'm going to create, I'll take an index card, right? And when I'm working in large team environments, oftentimes I'll actually start with those big, massive sticky notes, you know, and I'll use those and I'll stick them all over the walls and I'll wallpaper the room. But I take an index card and you start by writing, you know, I am a whatever at the top of the card, right? I am a shopping cart. Then you always define, you know, what this object is used for. I mean, why? What is its purpose? Why does it exist? You know, I hold products that a user has said they want to buy. Or I do, you know, whatever it is that, you know, that basically in one sentence summarizes, you know, why this object exists. What does it do? And then there are two other things that I write down. I write down, I am responsible for, and then I'll list the things that are just fundamentally, you know, in the case of a shopping cart, I'm responsible for, you know, storing products. I'm responsible for, you know, facilitating a checkout process or, you know, whatever it is that it's you know, its purpose is. And I am aware of. And then I list the things that this object would need to be aware of in order to do whatever it needs to do. In the case of a shopping cart, you know, I'm aware of the user that owns me. I'm aware of the products that I contain, right? Things like that. And when you do that, you notice that all your other objects that you need to model, they tend to show up inside of, you know, one definition. You know, the minute I do that, I know I need to create a product object. I know I need to create a user object if those are the things that I've written down. All of the, you know, I am responsible for, all of those statements should be things that have something to do with achieving that first one sentence that I wrote, you know, in terms of what its purpose is, right? Every single thing that I say it's responsible for should have something to do with achieving or doing whatever it is that I said its actual purpose of being is. Okay, so getting back to the slide here, the reason I say use a language common to the domain, when I do that paper prototyping with the index cards and I do one of those for each object, that's what I then have the customer or the client or whoever it is that wanted me to build this, I have them come in and look at that. And they actually, you know, when I use the big post-it notes, they walk around the room and they see a big piece of paper that says, you know, I am, you know, the shopping cart. I do this. I'm responsible for that. I'm aware of da-da-da-da. And I ask them if there's anything that they can think of that I haven't written down that I should have. You know, is there anything here that's not accurate or anything that's missing? And they don't have to be technical. I don't have to explain anything to them, you know, because they know what a shopping cart or a policy or a whatever it is that, you know, they've asked me to build. You know, they know what those things are because they work with them every single day. So that's why using a language common, you know, within the domain is extraordinarily important. It's very, very important. And the purpose and capabilities of an object being very clearly stated, and then all of your implementation decisions meeting that statement, that's not just about, you know, when I say I am responsible for, it has to actually have something to do with what I stated its purpose was. You also want to make sure that when you actually go to code the thing, make sure that every single function that goes in that object has something to do with achieving that purpose. Right? If it doesn't, then that function probably belongs in a different object. That's just a very good rule of thumb to follow. So you know what I typically do, whether I use the big post-it notes or not. I do end up getting it onto index cards, and when I know that I've got those index cards all right, I flip them over, and on the back of the index card is where I actually start writing the names of the methods. And when I'm all done, I've got a big stack of index cards that I can literally just hand off, you know, one card to each developer or to each team member or, you know, three of them or whatever. Typically, I hand them, you know, a card plus all the cards that are that thing would only be aware of, right? So the guy that does the cart object would probably also do, like, the product object. Doesn't have to, but it usually works well that way. All right. The idea that applications are made by distributed cooperation and communication between objects, and I wrote as opposed to central control. What that's all about, and I'll explain what this think hive actually means, but that's all about objects that are being aware of each, that are actually aware of each other. The idea that, you know, one object just, you know, is, you know, has a pointer, a variable, a property that is another object, and that it knows how to communicate with that object. It's responsible for treating one of those when it needs it, when it's constructed. It's the only thing aware of it, right? Like, there's no reason for, you know, one object to know about another if they never have to interact. If I have an object that only ever interacts with one other particular object, then that's the only place you'll ever see it being used. It's the only place it'll actually exist. It doesn't show up anywhere in my presentation tier or anything like that. And the application itself, if you build objects that are very intelligent, and the common phrase you'll hear object think theorists use is, think of every object as having its own little mini computer, right, or having its own brain. The idea that the object really is, you know, if you put yourself in its place, it really is aware of everything it needs to be aware of, and those things are aware of it, if that makes sense. And that they just interact with each other, and they know how to do that without asking anything else how to. That's actually how the applications get built. Right? I wrote Think Hive because that's a very common... Object theorists like to tell stories a lot, I've noticed. And one of the stories they tell is, from the real world, just to kind of defend or illustrate the concepts. In hive communities in nature, and the classic example they use is ants. I know bees live in hives. I don't know why they call it a hive colony or a hive community, but that is what they call it. The idea is that, you know, you have an anthill, lots and lots of ants live there. We all know that. You know, you're walking down the street, you got an ice cream cone, and you drop it, you know, maybe 10 feet away from the anthill, which is really far if you're an ant. But there's no one thing facilitating, you know, any you know, what the ants are doing. Somehow they all just manage to go, they find the food, you know, when they're out foraging, and they coordinate, you know, picking up this food and moving it back to wherever they take it back to and then processing it and doing whatever they do. But they do that just by talking to each other. There's nothing central controlling that. You know, I mean, yeah, there's a queen or whatever, but they don't, there's nothing actually saying, you know, all of you go over here or all of you go over there. They just know to do that, just by, you know, one hand interacting with the next one, interacting with the next one, interacting with the next one. You know, they just intelligently coordinate by talking one at a time to each other. And it works well in nature. That's how objects work in an object think application. Right? Like ants. Yeah. It's kind of a silly example, but it does illustrate the concept, right? Also, a very common thing that you read in most of the object think books, the idea that this simulation of a problem domain will drive your object discovery and your object definition. There's an adage they use a lot, which is if you write down the problem that you're trying to solve, you'll find the answer to that problem in the definition of the problem itself. So write down what it is you're trying to do. You know, or why it is you're having a difficult time doing what you're trying to do, and then look at what you wrote down. You'll see the names of a lot of your objects in what you've written. So, paper prototyping, I do strongly advise and strongly recommend, and the only way to get good at it is just to do it, right? And you don't have to study or do it. Just start writing down what it is you're going to do, right? I was doing this long before I had really gotten into reading much about object think. I'd always written things down. I just strongly recommend it anyway. So do that. Semantic net diagrams. It's another very useful technique. Semantic net, you know, for planning. What they are is really just a brainstorming tool. It's just a technique for brainstorming on paper. The idea being you literally just draw a little box for whatever it is, you know, whatever your object is, and then a line, and there's another little box. And then you just write the relationship in one or two words on that line. So you'll have, you know, cart, and then a line going to a box that says product, and it'll say contains along the line. That's it. You know, and product, you might say, you know, comes from, you know, catalog. You know, you might say user owns cart. Things like that, just that kind of a relationship. You find that depending on your domain, sometimes they end up actually forming a complete circle where every line connects to a different circle and they all add to a different object and they all actually end up just kind of being self-enclosed as a system. In some domains I've seen where it actually just kind of spiderwebs out. Right? It all depends on what it is you're defining. But it's an extremely useful brainstorming tool. There's no UML, no nothing. You always just do it with a white paper, you know, with a whiteboard or with paper. Right, you can use like a UML modeler to do it if you want, but you really don't need to. And one of the cardinal things to remember if you're going to do that, do it very, very fast at first. Just go into a room with whoever it is you're going to go in there with, or if you're doing it by yourself, fine, and just start immediately just saying, okay, what objects do I need? And just every single thing that comes to mind, just start writing them all down. You typically, after you do a semantic net diagram, you then just take a couple steps back, look at it, and start getting rid of, you know, just crossing out the things that, oh, no, I don't really need one of those. I don't really have this relationship. And you literally just get rid of the objects that it turns out you don't really need those. It's much, much easier and much faster, really, in the planning stages if you just write down everything that you might need to do and then sanity check it and get rid of the things that it turns out you don't really need to. And there are no dumb ideas when you're doing this. You know, I'll take a developer who's only been writing code for 3 weeks, and I'll let them do this with me, where everything they say out loud, I'll just put on, you know, I'll just put in the diagram. And if, you know, if it turns out we don't need 90% of them, it'll take me 1 minute to cross the 90% of them off. But, you know, it's a very good way to just, you know, to discover your objects, to, you know, take everything you may possibly need and remove the ones that you end up not needing. That's much, much easier to do than just only write down the things you know you're going to need and not make a mistake, right? There's no such thing as mistakes in this discovery process. It's all about just, you know, ending up, hopefully, at the end with what you really do need. It's a very good way to do that. So incorrect objects and relationships can be useful in a semantic net diagram. This third bullet there, if you're enlightened and you don't need a diagram, don't. That's something I'm always a little hesitant to say. I don't like talking about enlightenment with programmers. But a lot of the literature about object think does talk about that. This idea that if you get very, very used to thinking like the objects, to putting yourself in the first person, you ultimately, once you are an expert of a domain, you should be able to actually build that application without even diagramming it. Now, of course, in a team environment, that still wouldn't work. you'd still have to write something down. But the idea that, you know, you could actually get so good at this that you don't ever need to write things down is something you read quite a bit in Object Think. I haven't really ever agreed with that 100%. It's a nice idea, but in the real world, I'm typically working in a team environment, and I know that people aren't going to just read my mind. So, you know, I mean, you got to write stuff down and diagram it and, you know, kind of facilitate who's going to code what in the end. But it's a neat idea. All right. Placing functionality as close to the data that that functionality needs, that's really nothing to do with Object Think per se. That's really just a best practice with objects in general. But it is something that you want to be aware of. Right? If you're ever doubting whether or not, you know, should I really have put this function here or should I put it in that or what have you, you know, generally, you know, the idea is that your object stores information, typically, of, you know, some sort of information, and the functionality in that object, you know, typically works with that data. And if you ever find that you've got a function in an object, but the data that that function needs doesn't exist in that object and isn't something that that object should be responsible for retrieving, then the odds are that that function probably doesn't belong in that object. You know, you've put something in the wrong place. Objects are behavioral, not mechanical. I can't emphasize that enough. That is what it all boils down to. If you are putting yourself in the place of an object and thinking like it, and you're using anthropomorphism for actually discovering and planning your applications, your objects are behavioral. You will constantly, even through the development process, think about these things as living, breathing entities that interact with each other. It's just something that happens when you start developing this way, right? And it's not a bad way to think. I've found it extremely useful. I've just found that applications, when I'm building an application, it always makes common sense to me. Once I know the domain and I'm thinking like the, it just makes sense what that object needs to do and doesn't need to do because I'm actually putting myself, you know, in the place of that object. It makes it easier for me, anyway, to develop sometimes. Design patterns. I always like to mention design patterns when I talk about Object Think because I've read some Object Think books that say, you know, design patterns are bad, design patterns are evil. I've read some that say design patterns are terrific, you know. There's no reason not to use design patterns, you know, in your applications. Just don't let them change the way you think. So is there a middle ground? I don't know. I don't personally find them very useful when you're taking an Object Think approach, aside from when I'm designing maybe tiers of the application, because sometimes there are things that you need to do that have nothing to do with, you know, anthropomorphism and thinking like your business domain. For example, that business domain has to talk to a presentation tier somewhere, right? I mean, how you decide to achieve that isn't what I want to really get into, but obviously design patterns could be useful for modeling that relationship. Just depends on what you're going to do. If nothing else, I always tell people, and I said in my design pattern talk, they're an excellent learning tool. I always recommend, you know, reading design patterns, playing with them. You know, you learn things from reading them and from trying to implement them, whether you end up becoming a design pattern nut or not. So the benefits, the things you actually get from doing this, all right, typically it does result in much fewer objects. Certainly in the world of Java, that's been the case. I see Java applications that people build that literally have over 1,000 classes, I mean 1,000 objects. In ColdFusion, with an Object Think approach, I don't think I've ever had more than about 15 objects, maybe 20 objects tops in any application I've built. Right? I mean, and some of these are pretty complicated applications. I still haven't needed more than that taking this approach. But, you know, and a good example would be, you know, in Object Think, you know, they don't really encourage doing things like a data access object, right? So you've got an object, and then having another object that facilitates talking to the data, you don't do that. The object is aware of how to commit itself to a database and where to get its data and that kind of thing, which from a maintenance point of view can, you know, it does mean you've got to open up that core file. You don't open up some other thing that's just responsible for that. It'll mean rewriting all of your queries, you know, in the objects themselves if you want to move over to a different database platform. I mean, that is a side effect of this. But, you know, if every object had four DAOs to talk to four different databases, you know, as opposed to the way you would do an Object Think, well, that's more objects. And Java developers tend to do that, create lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of objects, and usually in some really ridiculous directory structure. But I don't know why Java developers do that. But anyway, you do end up with much fewer objects. And that does happen in ColdFusion as well. More intelligent objects, right? Think of them as little computers. That is definitely one of the benefits of using ObjectThink. Your objects tend to be much more reusable, much more flexible, right? Code that is easier to maintain. That's debatable. I mean, it depends on, you know, what you've built and what you built without using ObjectThink, obviously. It's not like this is the only way to write code that's easy to maintain. But I will tell you that it's generally very easy to follow the code. Because everything you've developed has nothing to do with anything but the business domain in terms of the way your CFCs and such are being used. It's usually very easy. If there's a problem with the shopping cart, there's nowhere to go but the shopping cart object. There aren't other objects that it, you know, that are doing any of the work of that. It's just right there. All right. Better chance of project success. That has been my experience. Every time I've implemented this approach, right, I've yet to do this and not have the project get built on time, under budget, and be a success. The client usually is very happy because they know how to maintain it. You know, even their non-technical people, you know, can look at, I mean, like I said, can actually look at my directory structure and the names of the CFCs, and they actually know where I've coded the things to do the stuff that they know is actually happening in the code. Whether they understand how I coded it or not, that's another story. But they would actually know what file to open just because it makes sense to them. I find it much, 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 much easier to maintain. And because these objects are kind of behavioral and, you know, and you've developed them that way, when a client comes and says, oh, you know, we decided we want to do this instead of that, you know, and I need to make changes, I find, and in an agile development environment in particular, I find that it makes it very, very easy to react to those changes and implement them. Not that I like scope creep or anything, but, you know, if you're going to try to keep the client happy and you're going to try to deal with the fact that, you know, they are changing requirements on you or adding requirements or what have you, it typically is much easier to deal with in an ObjectThink environment. Okay. Yes? You want to know, I have a shopping cart object, and I want to know how many shopping carts are in general are out there? Well, usually, like in an e-commerce application, I usually have something like a catalog. If I have a business domain that requires reporting, I will try to object model the things that would be responsible for being aware of that report information. I don't advise you to create one cart in memory for each one of the carts that you're going to then, you know, get the info. If you want to do that, that's, you know, more power to you, but it's going to be pretty slow. You don't want to have lots and lots of objects in memory for no reason. But I do, I mean, in more smaller scale situations, I do that. For example, if I have a user object, right? And when you log into the application, you know, I immediately create a user object for you in the session scope or wherever. And then I happen to be an administrator, and I'm going to go and I'm going to edit other users. I will reuse, you know, the user object, and I will reuse I always do the presentation tier with reusable, you know, UI components. And I will just pass a different user object to the same tag and have that object in memory of whatever user I want to administer. In an admin environment, that's typically okay if you're just administering one, you know, instance of one object. Because, you know, you don't have lots and lots and lots of admins usually working on it. But, yeah, in a situation like that, if you needed to, like, get the information for 1,000 carts, I wouldn't recommend creating 1,000 objects. I would try very hard not to do that. The code to do what? To generate the reporting engine? Mm-hmm. No, it wouldn't be in the cart object. It would be some sort of an actual aggregator object, some sort of a reporting object. I mean, an actual reporting engine. I mean, I would try to think of in the real world what would I call that, and I would try to come up with some name that would make sense. But no, it would be something that literally just ran the query to get the information and returned it. But the point is, the way I would approach thinking about it is as some sort of an entity whose only purpose is to provide me with report information. That's where the code would go. But a shopping cart would only be aware of the things in that shopping cart. It would be completely unaware of other carts, for example. Yeah. No. Like the queries for getting information, you know, for a cart would be in the cart. The queries for getting information about an actual product would be in a product. If I had a reporting thing that also had to run the same query, only it wasn't specific to one cart, I would have the exact same query in that object. You know, you will find that if, you know, usually if you've modeled your domain right, you don't end up with queries in more than one place. But I wouldn't have anything that's actually wrapping up like the database itself. Not generally. I do that sometimes in sample apps when I need to just have like some, I just need to put like my data access stuff somewhere just to make it simple. And usually I'm not even talking to a database. I've like actually manually and then I just got some silly CFC, but there's nothing object oriented about it. It's just a CFC with a bunch of like data access methods for just giving me data. All right. So more reusable code. I definitely, at least in my experience, it's been extraordinarily reusable. You know, I typically, for any given application, if the domain that we come up with for that application includes objects that I've had to build in other domains, I can usually just copy them over, change the queries, because obviously the database is different for a different client. But other than that, everything just works. Right? I do the same thing with my presentation tier. Right? If I have a user object, I have a user tag. I've got a shopping cart object, and I've got a shopping cart tag. And I'll just move the tag and the object over to, you know, whatever application needs it. One of the problems is that obviously if you have objects that are dependent on each other, like if I have a shopping cart object, but it's not really going to be able to work unless I have a product object as well, for example, well, I'm going to have to know to copy them both over. You know, I mean, if I copy one over, not the other, it's going to be a problem. And so long as I don't have, you know, a real big library of these, that's not much of a problem. But ultimately, I mean, what I've started doing on my laptop is actually organizing these in a directory structure so that anytime I need to use these things, I can just, you know, copy the ones that are all dependent on each other out of one place, just to make my life a little easier. At some point, I'll put that out, you know, so people can just use that code if they ever want to use it. But you do end up with pretty reusable code. And then transferable skills, right, and better developers. The goal of ObjectThink is to make you a better developer. It is just to give you a very good school of thought, very good approach to development and to planning development that does work in whatever object-oriented environment you want to go to. I use this technique when I do Flex development. I use this technique when I do Java development. I use this technique when I do ColdFusion development. It is a nice transferable skill. Right? You should be able to use it in pretty much any environment you want to. So I do like that. And it should make you a better developer. Quite honestly, I mean, anytime you learn anything new that kind of shows you a different approach, it should make you a better developer. Anyway. So where would I recommend you go from here in terms of how to kind of start practicing or look at examples or what have you? And in a minute, I'll talk about some of the literature that's out there. But certainly, if you're not currently modeling your domain or writing down what it is that you're trying to represent in your code before you code it, start doing that. I mean, definitely start doing that. And try to put yourself in the place of those objects. Try to think like the things that you're talking about, the things that you're going to represent. Okay? Try doing paper prototyping. It's really easy to do. You know, that just, I mean, and it's not like it's expensive. I mean, it's like $1 to buy a pack of index cards from 7-Eleven. You know, this is, you're never going to have cheaper equipment than this. And you'll probably never have more valuable equipment than whiteboards and index cards. You know, those for me are an absolute necessity. I can do 90% of what I don't know about 90, but I can probably do 75% of what I need to do in any application without having a computer. You know, I mean, just doing it all on paper that way. All that's left is the implementation, and you know, writing code is not rocket science in any language. It's knowing what it is that you need to build. You know, what it is that you need to implement, actually planning the application, that's tough. So definitely try doing that and semantic net diagrams, you know, brainstorm. I always tell developers there's no such thing as waiting too long to write the code. You know, plan for as long as you feel like you need to plan before you start writing the code. I never discourage that. Try to code things so that they're very encapsulated. I strongly recommend getting in that practice. If you don't do it now, right, keep your data private. You know, make your code self-documenting and easy to read. That has nothing to do with ObjectThink, but that's something that when you start implementing this and you start developing your objects that way, you'll find in particular, if you work in an environment where other people are going to look at the code, you might have to work in a team environment especially. if you're the only one in that environment who's used to thinking this way or who really takes this approach, you're really going to want to be careful about, you know, making sure that everything really is data in and data out. You want to make sure that everything's very well commented and very da-da-da. And try to explain to people why you built it the way you built it. Because the minute you get one developer in that environment who decides to do a DAO or decides to do a one of these, or decides, now you've got two completely different approaches to development, and that doesn't work very well. That's been one of the challenges in this, is that anytime I architect an application, just from a purely from an architectural point of view, and then go to have a team implement it, I actually have to sit down with the people in that team and explain to them this approach. I always involve them in the planning of the application, even if we really don't have the time for them to be involved in that, or if they're not architects and they really are just people that just write code and maybe they have 1 year of experience or whatever. I still involve them in the actual architecting stages so that they understand why it is I'm asking them to build things the way I'm asking them to build it. If they don't understand that, it's going to be very difficult for them to work in that environment. So follow my blog, definitely. I'm going to start writing some about ObjectThink. I don't want to get carried away with it, but I will. That methodology that people have been asking me to document is the way I approach development is based on ObjectThink. And that methodology is fundamental if you want to take the same approach that I do. It is fundamental to think this way. So I will be putting some documentation and stuff out there, that I think is going to be a little more applicable just to Cold Fusion. You know, using these approaches, they won't just be theory, kind of stuff. But I will be putting more sample apps out. I will try to explain myself a little more, because I've come to appreciate that putting code out there or just releasing, like, here's a set of rules to follow, doesn't cut it for most people. I think it'd be more valuable for me to write more about why an application looks the way it does than to just put the application out there and expect people to download it and play with it and understand why it is the way it is. I don't think that that's very fun for a lot of people. So I will start doing a lot of that. And then I've got some other references. So some people who I've read, I found have influenced the way I think and the way I approach development quite a bit. And one of them is Dr. Parnas. He's kind of the godfather of object everything. He's a very old school guy in object-oriented programming and ObjectThink and so on and so forth. He's been around forever. He started writing about object theory back in the 60s, I think, late 60s. He's written lots of white papers, lots of essays. Hasn't written that many books. I've never read any of his books, but I've read many of his white papers. And I've seen him lecture as well. He's an academic. He's very interesting to see lecture if you ever get a chance. Though I believe right now he's on sabbatical in Ireland. So if you live in Ireland, go find him. And Christopher Alexander. Anybody here heard of Christopher Alexander or read any of his stuff? Yeah? Did you read any of his books? Yeah, he's written a bunch of books, yeah. I think he's written 7 or 8, 9 books, something like that. I noted a few books there that are interesting. Notes on Synthesis of Form, I thought was actually a very interesting book. A Pattern Language is actually, I didn't like that book very much, but it is the book that designed, the term design pattern came from that book. Christopher Alexander is an architect. I mean, an actual architect. He does nothing to his software, really. But he's written a lot about how to approach design in a very different way to what other architects, were doing back then, and he, to this day, still does. He did things that were kind of, people consider very radical, like, when he was asked to design a college campus once. And and he had to plan the thing, where all the paths are going to go to the buildings and da da da, where the buildings are going to go. And what he did was he put little tents up instead of putting buildings, and he just told the students to just do what you're going to go do. And there were no sidewalks or anything. And basically, he let the students bear a path through the grass, and he said, okay, that's where you want to put your sidewalks. I mean, brilliant, right? I mean, it's kind of. But I will warn you, I've read three books, and I've kind of started flipping through the third. He does write a lot about actual architecture, you might not enjoy it too much. His book, The Timeless Way of Building, that one I found very, very interesting to read, but I was a philosophy major, so I found it interesting. It's like ridiculously zen. It's really like, he just talks about very far out kind of like, You know, the best way I can describe it is when I was reading that book, I hit a there's like three or four pages I was reading in the beginning that, you know, basically if you ever seen the Ghostbusters and they have the like I am the gatekeeper, I am the key master kind of. Yeah, that's exactly what he was writing. Like, I think they must have like stolen those lines from his book. And you read it, you're like, what the hell does this have to do with anything? It's really surreal. But it does change the way you think about some things. It's interesting. Cunningham and Beck, these guys are... Yes?
I actually had a question about Alexander. I didn't know what he did, but applied to optic things. Like, remember, he's the road to start using it. He's sort of actually the father of modern design patterns.
Yeah.
Which doesn't jive with what optic things describe. But with the theory of pi, a lot of people are sort of applying it. There's a lot of common problems they encounter, like class exclusion and inheritance hierarchies.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I mean, I've never built a CFF that required more than about 12 or 15 objects. I mean, obviously, I didn't have much of an inheritance, chain there. If somebody actually gets into a situation where they do have that many objects, it would be something I'd advise against doing. I'd be very careful not to do it. I don't know that object thing really encourages inheritance. I mean, aside from you doing it when it makes sense, I think inheritance is very powerful. And most of what I've read about object think doesn't get too much into implementation, but you're right. I mean, if you do take an approach that ends up using a lot of inheritance, you're going to find that becomes a bit of a problem to maintain.
Right.
OptiThink isn't really so much about, I mean, it's about intelligent objects is what it's about. There is no pattern there per se. They just talk to each other. And inheritance doesn't really come into it very, very much. I mean, it hasn't been a problem for me yet. Certainly not in cold fusion development. You know, I mean, I've yet to teach anybody this approach, even somebody who's only been doing development for 6 months or 7 months, and had them have their code get out of control. I mean, it hasn't happened. I'm not sure if that means it's impossible. It could happen. I would say that, you know, definitely, like I said, if you read design patterns, it will probably make you a little more aware of some of the potential problems, you know, that are out there. I mean, you want to be aware of, you know, not just what solutions people have written down, but what it was that these are solutions to. You know, be aware of the problem that somebody came up with a pattern in order to solve. Yes? No, I'm just saying I've never been in an environment where I ended up with more than about 12 or 15 objects when I modeled the domain. There were some in there. I mean, I think the largest I did was about, got up to about 20 objects in the domain or something like that. Is it a bad thing to have lots and lots of objects? I mean, if it makes sense to have them, then no. But I think it's a bad thing to code not using this technique. I mean, you know, if you learn this technique, this approach, and you do it, you typically don't need many objects. But I mean, I wouldn't say that having a lot of objects is bad, I mean, per se, you know. I don't think it is. I don't think it's difficult to follow when you build apps this way. Yeah, I get that a lot. You know, people say things like, you know, hey, but what if I stop using SQL Server and I use Oracle? If I had a data access object, I could just point. And I go, okay, well, you know, like in 11 years, I've twice had to switch databases. Things like where I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, you're right. It is more maintenance sometimes to do that. But it's easy to know where you go to maintain, I mean, from that point of view. But, I mean, you're right. There are some advantages to not taking this approach that you get. I mean, certainly. Yes.
Having a lot of things in one class, also makes it harder to access separately. Like, is there
that hasn't been my experience. I mean, you'll have more methods on that one object to test instead of, you know, a smaller number of methods on a larger number of objects, I would think. When I actually implement this and I do my construction, as I go, I test the methods, usually with just a simple test page. I don't typically use, like, a unit tester, but I have done that and tried that, and I think unit tests are actually quite good. But the problem is it gets really problematic when you're doing, like, objects that are interacting with each other and stuff, and there's one common method you call that then triggers lots of other things calling each other. It's hard to, you know, I mean, if there's a bug in those, it's going to be really difficult to track if you're using a unit tester. So I find that I kind of test those independently of the thing they're dependent on. I try to do that, you know, to be honest with you. I try to just not write bugs in general, though it never works out that way. it'd be nice if that happened. Anyway, a few other people, just real quick. Robert Glass, this guy's written some very interesting white papers. His book, Facts and Fallacies of Software Engineering, is terrific. This is one of the few guys who come. He's very, very academic, but he does a lot in the real world as well. And he tends to write a lot about the differences between practical, you know, real implementation and what people say in theory. Brad Cox, another guy who just, if you ever get a chance to read some of his white papers, and right now he's doing a lot of work on something he calls super distribution, which is a very interesting concept, you know, idea of having objects in a server somewhere, and then you can build an app on another server, and the objects all just get pulled in and interact with each other. It's kind of neat, but I don't know how he's going to make that happen. I listed a couple linguistics authors there as well. The two books I would very, very strongly recommend. One of them is something called Streamlined Object Modeling, which rather than using design patterns, it takes an object think approach, but then they've written something called collaboration patterns to define how they talk to each other, which is pretty interesting. And the last one I recommend is a book that's actually called Object Thinking. It's published by Microsoft Press. It was written by a guy who's a Smalltalk developer, but he wrote it figuring that it would be Java developers that would read the book. So it was kind of I don't know how that all ended up at a Microsoft Press, but it's an extremely good book. Very, very good book if you want to learn Object Think. So anyway, if anybody has any of their questions about this, feel free to come up and let me know. Talk to me about it. I hope you guys have had a very good conference. Hope I see a lot of you tomorrow, wandering around, having a good time. And next year as well.
Thank you for listening, and we hope we will see you at CF United 2007. This has been a production by TerraTech Programming. For more information, go to www.cfunited.com.